Hi there. Welcome to Unstuck, the podcast where we have conversations about areas in our life where we may have been or are stuck. Whether that is relationally, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually, and often because we are intricately connected human beings, it is a few of these areas all at once. I'm the host of Unstuck, Dr. Emily Stone. I'm a marriage and family therapist, as well as an ordained minister, and issues related to growth, formation, and development are passions of mine. I love having conversations with people and can't wait to share with you some amazing people like you, and their stories. Hey friends, this podcast episode's interview might be one of the most sacred I ever do. Amanda Kerr is a third-year graduate student at Wake Forest Divinity School, where she is preparing for ministry. I met Amanda about 4 years ago and have had the honor of witnessing an incredibly tender and significant part of her life. Amanda is so many things. She is warm, intelligent, wise, brave, and caring. She is also a gay Christian woman. Today, I get to share with you her thoughts on how she has worked to remain faithful as a Christian, while also being honest with others and authentic in her identity. Her thoughtful and intentional responses will challenge and encourage you. Come and see. Okay. Yay! Okay, can I take a picture of us?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Because here's the thing. You are like my first... Okay, I was a little cheesy. Well, okay.
We can do it again.
Okay. Okay, I took three. You are my first, in fact, I need to make sure I put you over here. You're my first one to do by phone. So,
okay.
Yeah, kind of exciting. I just start talking, kind of just find out how you're doing and all that stuff. But first, so, and I've got my questions ready and all of that. But yes, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Life's busy right now. Super busy.
Well, I see you posting all kinds of things. Like, I'm like, what else is she involved in? Like, she is doing everything right now.
Yeah. I make it through because I know there's an end.
Okay.
So, just with school and the job, I'm working at a church in Greensboro and getting married this summer.
Congratulations. I know I said it online, but congratulations.
Yeah. Life's going to be crazy for the next 4 or 5 months, but then I know that hopefully there will be a much more sustainable rhythm.
Yeah.
So just trying to soak it all up while I can.
I'm still saying that, Amanda, but good luck with that.
Yeah.
That's okay. Time flies by so fast. So from what you just said, are you graduating with your MDiv this spring?
Or yes.
Oh my gosh. I feel like
isn't
you just
crazy?
Moved there. Oh my goodness. Okay. Congrats. Well, are you kind of in your MDiv program? Do you have like an internship and then also a big paper to write?
So they actually give you the option your third year if you want to do a thesis kind of paper or if you just want to do a third year internship.
Okay.
And then do some like practical ministry reflection on that internship. So I kind of have a framing question that I'm working with at a local nonprofit here in Winston.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. So I have so many things I want to ask you about that aren't even on my list. So I'm just going to start there first. So,
great.
I hope you don't go to bed early.
If we were starting at 9, I was ready.
Okay. My last one, we had coffee recently and she was like, I was really tired. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm kind of a night owl. And my kids all go to bed. So this is the best time to do it. Otherwise you kind of hear them in the background. So
that's what I figured.
Yeah. Okay. So where are you doing your MDiv?
Mm-hmm. I'm at Wake Forest University School of Divinity.
Okay.
Up in Winston-Salem.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure I had that right. Okay. Yeah. And then, so I usually say a little bit about how I remember meeting you for the first time. And you're one of those people, Amanda, that I follow online and then hear about and then engage with you online a little bit to the point where I feel like you're like my good friend and you really aren't. like, we don't, like, hang out. We're not, like, you know. But I'm like, oh, yeah, Amanda, she's, we're, yeah, we're tight.
That's how I feel like, too. I'm like, we're in each other's corner, you know, yes. Even if it's virtually. Like, yes. Occasionally, you're like, I'm here.
Yes, yes.
And I like what you're doing.
Exactly. Like, I feel that, yeah, both ways. Absolutely. So, I do remember meeting you at a lunch one time. And where were we eating? It was like an Italian.
At Dusty's house.
Oh, was it? Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which can feel like a restaurant.
Yes, it can. Oh my gosh, with how many, the tables and the chairs.
Oh, and the Dusty. Buffet line.
Yes, yes. And the way Jim puts out all the drinks and you can pick your drink and yeah, yeah. So I just always remember thinking that you seemed like such a, okay, so the word that comes in my mind, I'm not sure if this is going to make sense, but like rich and textured. So like there was obviously this depth to you and there, I knew, okay, there's lots of stories there. And that's just kind of what the sense I got from you, right away. So, and I knew that if there was ever a chance, I thought, yeah, Amanda and I would be friends. We totally would be. So I want to know what, I guess I want to hear a synopsis of what, of kind of your background, your story, like where you were born and just, you know, as much as you want to tell, just to kind of give some context to who you are.
Yeah, of course. I grew up in Charlotte and both my parents grew up there and their parents. So we have heavy roots in Charlotte, North Carolina. My dad worked at UNC Charlotte and my mom is a substance abuse counselor.
I didn't know that. So okay.
So was raised in a family of people who are passionate about serving their community and serving other people, which definitely impacted me and my two younger sisters. So I'm the oldest of three girls.
Okay.
Both my sisters, all three of us are really close. My family is really close.
You can tell that online. It comes across like with, there's a genuineness there. You can tell. Yeah.
Right, right. No, it really is real, like our relationships and our care for one another, and we're really invested in one another's lives, which I'm really thankful that my parents kind of set that as a standard and as the example for us growing up. So a big part of our family and growing up as a cur was going to church. I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, a great faith community in North Charlotte, which was a huge part of my life and felt kind of like a second family to me. We were there every time the doors were open, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. And so that faith community really nourished and influenced a lot of who I was as I was growing up with a lot of my close relationships there.
Yeah, yeah.
So raised in that faith community, and then for undergrad, went to NC State University.
Okay.
And I actually majored in business there, which to a lot of people kind of surprises them. And I think, one, because I was interested in marketing in high school, so I thought that would be cool. But also, I had plans to go and be an international missionary after I graduated from college.
Okay.
And that, kind of like you said, stories within stories of how that was a plan. And for many international missionaries, they kind of major in something that can be easily transferable from one culture to another.
I've heard that.
So,
yeah.
That was the plan with business. And I was really involved in Campus Crusade, which is a college ministry, and worked at a Christian summer camp. In the summers in between undergrad. So was once again really involved in faith communities and Christianity throughout college. So, yes, all those things are important. And then after I graduated, pretty soon after I graduated, I went on something called the World Race, which some people know of and other people don't. It's a it's not the Amazing Race.
I was about to say, were you on TV, Amanda? Did I miss it?
I had many people say, like, when are you going to be on TV? Or, oh my gosh, that's cool. No, the World Race is a missions trip, kind of, an extended mission trip, mission year, where you go to 11 countries in 11 months.
Wow.
And so you go and you spend 1 month in different countries and in different communities, partnering with local churches or local organizations who are there 365 days out of the year, and you kind of help them with their work. Okay. And so it really provides people who's in their 20s and early 30s with the opportunity to travel to build relationships. But also evangelism was a heavy part of that mission work.
Okay.
So I did that in 2012 to 2013.
Okay. How old were you then?
I was...
Was that right after college?
That was a year after I graduated.
Okay.
So 23.
Okay.
23 to 24.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a trip for a 23-year-old. So, yeah. That's awesome.
Yes. And for me, like I said, I was really interested in international missions, so I viewed it as opportunity for me to go and see a lot of different places and form a lot of different contacts and hopefully get some sense of where I could be long term.
Okay.
So that was kind of my vision in doing that.
What were some of the places that you visited that you could name all of them, and I guess I'm interested in the ones that stand out to you the most.
So we spent 6 months in Asia, 3 months in Eastern Africa, and then 2 months in Eastern Europe.
Okay.
And that was the order that we went in.
Okay.
So I would say I always think about Nepal because it was just a super, super beautiful place and beautiful people.
Yeah.
I was really passionate about anti-human trafficking work at that time, and Nepal is kind of like a central hub for where some of that takes place.
Okay.
So that kind of connected me with the work that was happening there, but also the church that we stayed in literally was in the valley of the Himalayan mountains.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So that is what we woke up to and came home to every day.
Oh, I'm dying. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that sounds amazing. That's a place I've always wanted to go. So I love traveling too. That's amazing. That's great. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it was at the beginning of our trip, so it just felt great to really be disconnected and in a completely new place with a family and church that showed us so much hospitality.
Yeah.
So I definitely loved going there. I also, one place that was surprising was we went to Cambodia. And up until that point, I didn't know too much about the history of that country because of when I was born. So to connect with the people in that country who were recovering from so much trauma and civil war that had taken place. And I'm still really good friends with a Cambodian woman who lives there. And we talk on probably a weekly basis.
Wow.
And so I'm really thankful for that's a relationship that's continued to grow and build. And we kind of stay in touch with what's going on in each other's lives. So
that says a lot about you too. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So yeah. I love those places. And, I'm trying to think, let's see, we stayed in, it was Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. And those were all three beautiful places. One of the more, entertaining stories that I remember happened, or actually two of the more entertaining stories happened in Africa. One of them being when I accidentally dropped my only pair of flip-flops down a Maasai latrine in Kenya. And we had, like, several more months to go, and this is my only pair of flip-flops because we backpacked, so, like, we didn't have a lot. And with permission of, like, our Maasai leader, I constructed a, like, fishing hook with a carabiner and floss and was able to get it down the 30-foot latrine and retrieve my flip-flop.
How long did
and
that take you?
I had an audience of Maasai people.
Are they start calling you MacGyver?
Probably something else, but yeah, I'm sure there was a name for me. They just couldn't believe that I would do that. I mean, I guess I could have probably bought a new pair of sandals, but in my mind, this was my only pair, so.
Yeah. That is amazing. Wow. Okay. Yeah, that takes a lot of determination. Yeah. And probably some time and patience. Uh-huh. Oh, my goodness. That is a long time to be traveling in different countries. Did you have a lot of culture shock?
I will say I did, because our first country was India.
Uh-huh.
And so in some ways it was good, because you're really pumped up when you're about to go, so you're ready just for it. And in some ways, as much as you can be, you're ready for something different and to travel the world. So to start out in India and then to end in Lithuania was probably the best. Okay. Going from the most extreme, cultural differences to something that was pretty similar.
Right. No, that makes sense going and coming back, I would think, because did you have reverse culture shock as well when you came back to the States?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I remember, my middle sister was getting married within 2 months of me getting back. And so I kind of jumped straight into wedding season, which I was excited to do because I had already missed a lot and wanted to. But the priorities and the plans and all of the things that needed to get done could not have been more different from what my life had been for the past 11 months. So that definitely did take some adjustment for sure. And thankfully my family and friends were really attentive to that and listening. So
that's good. Yeah. I've had a few friends who've had similar kind of years abroad and have shared, and clients too, actually coming back, just sharing about it, just what you're saying, kind of, and some of them even experiencing some anger and having to kind of calm themselves down so they're not snappy with people and, you know, say things that, and because the other people didn't have that year and they don't, you know, and this is life for them. It's just different. So,
I remember it being really weird for me to think that once I was back here in the States doing whatever I was doing, that those communities were still existing in the same way that I experienced them.
Okay.
And to know that these two realities were happening simultaneously, that I hadn't left, that wasn't a completely different existence.
Yeah, right. That's still going on over there.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I will say that it also has been really helpful just to give me a lot of context and a lot of emotional connection. Now when I hear the news and when I hear different things that are going on, because I have relationships that are there. I have some investment memories that are there.
I think it builds empathy too. Uh-huh. And it's harder to have firm judgments on various things. I don't know. I feel like it puts you in a different kind of listening space with people when those kind of cross-cultural experiences, it changes you, forever. So you were over there for 11 months. Then what came after that?
So then I came back and, the next two years. Wow. A lot happened in 2 years. That is when, I stayed in Charlotte, because my parents lived here and I had no money. So I stayed here, lived with them to save some money. And I began doing restaurant marketing with actually Chick-fil-A.
Yep. I remember that. Yeah.
So I did that for 2 years, and lived at home, saved money. And that really kind of gave me the space to process a lot of what I had experienced. Mm-hmm. And let some questions and some curiosities kind of come up in me. It kind of gave me the space and ability to do that after being gone.
Before I forget, I've seen you post online that you were involved with the Reformation Project.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the Reformation Project the Reformation Project as a whole is an organization that promotes LGBTQ inclusion in Christian faith communities. Mm-hmm. So it's called the Reformation Project because they're about reforming church teaching on LGBTQ individuals in the Christian context.
Right, okay.
So that organization was actually founded by Matthew Vines, who's pretty popular for his YouTube video and his book, God and the Gay Christian. And I had the honor this time a year ago to be a part of their leadership cohort, where you spend essentially a semester studying all types of affirming, unaffirming Christian theologies and learning how to have engaging dialogues and conversations with people about this topic.
Okay.
So that they're sending out young reformers, and middle-aged and old reformers all over the country.
Okay. And their conference this year, I've listened to some of their talks. So mm-hmm. were they in Chicago? Is that where they
yes,
were?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I've always wanted to visit Chicago, always. So, I've heard it was this fall, right? Was it cold yet?
Yeah, it was just the past couple months ago. I wasn't able to go.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
Those conferences they have every year for anyone to come.
Okay.
And often they are like a sort of reunion for leadership cohorts.
Okay.
But, my leadership cohort spent about 4 or 5 days together in Los Angeles last May.
Okay. Okay.
Kind of
that's a pretty nice place to meet too.
So that one was okay as well.
Yeah.
But kind of like a curriculum intensive.
Okay.
And getting to meet some of the authors and theologians we had studied and learn directly from them, which is pretty cool.
Okay. So that makes me think of two questions I have. One, kind of to lead us into our topic and one of the reasons why I brought you on here, besides the fact that you're just an awesome human being, is what makes you so invested and interested in the Reformation Project yourself?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's a great question. So actually, part of my story is that 3 years ago, I made the decision to come out as a gay Christian. I had struggled for most of my life with same-sex attraction, and it was something that caused a lot of shame and anxiety and even, like, self-hatred in my own life. It was a really, really difficult part of even my identity as a Christian because I was constantly wanting to be enough and be who God wanted me to be. But I had daily reminders that I was flawed and that there was something wrong with me that was completely unacceptable to God. And it was something that I didn't really feel like I had a choice over, which made it even more difficult and something that in which I felt very misunderstood by others in my same-sex attraction. So I really began a journey. Once I got back from the world race, I started having a lot of questions and curiosities about kind of the expanse of the Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. It was when I actually was on that year-long mission trip that I realized there's great diversity of Christian thought, that there were more denominations and Christian experiences outside of the one that I was raised in, that Christianity isn't this one thing. Yeah. And so as I began to open up and to read some different authors and to see there were different perspectives on how to live a faithful Christian life, I encountered theologians and Christian writers who affirmed LGBTQ people. And I had literally never heard of that. And of course, I was very skeptical. I was taught not to really trust my own kind of desires or my own longings or the things that I wanted in life. And so it sounded too good to be true. But I remember in Charlotte going and meeting with an affirming pastor that I found online and literally mm-hmm. saying, "How in the world can you believe this?" So for myself, I had this really long, difficult journey of coming to terms with my sexuality and to the point where I was able to accept it as a part of the way God created me and as a beautiful part of who I am and not something to be hated or shamed or to reject. So because of my own really personal investment in this conversation, I wanted to become even more equipped to have these conversations.
Yeah.
First and foremost, with people who themselves are struggling with their own sexuality or gender identity, and how do I live a faithful life? Can I still be a member of a church? Will I still be welcomed by God? First and foremost for those people, but also for their families, for their faith communities, because I'm aware of all the statistics that are out there about what LGBTQ youth and individuals are up against. And you see that those statistics double when they're in families and faith communities who reject who they are, around mental health, around suicide, things like that. So there's a lot of personal investment on my end because I know how influential church teaching can be in someone's life like mine.
Yeah. So it sounds like it was partly, and I feel like this is what it it so often is for people, whatever it is that they are studying or working with, it's partly for yourself and for others, but I think it has to be that way because you have to work through it yourself to be able to live out that message with others too, with authenticity and sincerity. So yeah, that makes sense. So I guess I'm curious, you said you met with different theologians and you read a lot of books and some of the authors. Who were some of your favorites that you read?
Yes, I would say, so two of the theologians and authors who we worked with and studied and learned from a lot was Dr. Cheryl Anderson, who's the professor of Old Testament at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Illinois. And then also Dr. Jim Brownson, who wrote a famous book called Bible, Gender, Sexuality. And he is a New Testament professor at Western Theological Seminary in Michigan. So those were two. We read Dr. Brownson's entire book, which was super helpful and really approaches this conversation from the question of moral logic. So he's saying, in order for us to take something that was written over 2,000 years ago and apply it to today, we have to ask the question of why. Like, why was this important? And get to the underlying moral logic of it. And that moral logic is what we can transfer and kind of apply to our current context. And so he looks at a lot of the passages in the Old and New Testament and basically concludes that the moral logic undergirding these six kind of clobber texts really didn't have anything to do with this idea of faithful, covenantal, loving, same-sex relationships that were that included two people of equal power. But there were often other things at play, and that's what was raising the big concern about these kind of relationships. And Cheryl Anderson, she is a African-American female. And one of the things that the Reformation Project is really committed to, which is one of the reasons I was interested in it, is the work of intersectionality within this conversation. Because often the gay movement has been centered on white male experiences. And so making sure that we're aware that as we have this conversation, especially women, people of color, transgender individuals, but this is a much more difficult experience, or there's a lot more factors at play for people of color than for white individuals. So that was one of the things that Dr. Anderson kind of focused on in her time with us.
So they were both actually with you then?
That's we read their stuff ahead of time, and then they came and were present during our, like, in-person intensive.
You should have gotten some sort of class credit for that.
Which is pretty... I did. I did.
I'm sitting here thinking, like, you're in seminary.
I investment in some of my classes, and so I asked my theology professor if she would, like, oversee an independent study.
Smart.
Which was great because we were able to meet once a week, and that was another person I could process with in person.
Very cool.
Oh, yes.
That's awesome. I could probably, and maybe we'll come back to that. Any other books or books that you would recommend for someone who is exploring this or, on either side of the aisle, or so to speak, whether it's personal or because they're family or whatever?
I would say that one of the top books out there that I recommend to a lot of people that isn't really new, but I think is just a great beginner to this conversation is Torn by Justin Lee. So many people have heard of that book. And like I said, it was written probably at this point, maybe 10 years ago. I could be really off by that. But he was the founder of the Gay Christian Network, that actually just kind of changed its name. But he kind of puts his story out there in that book, not to even say, I need you to change your mind or I need you to think the way I think, but I just need you to understand what this is like. And he grew up in a context very similar to mine. He actually grew up at the church that I went to while I was at NC State, which was really weird.
Oh, wow.
I realized that. So our worlds were pretty similar. So to grow up in a more conservative Christian context, this is what this experience is like. And even when you try and do everything everyone tells you to do to change or to fix this or to get right with God, what that leads to, and that it really doesn't lead to anything life-giving. So he just really puts his story out there in a really accessible way.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
So that's a good one. And then, of course, Matthew Vine's God and the Gay Christian is a little bit more academic for the average person, but he really investigates these six clobber texts that people often talk about.
Okay.
And says, yeah.
Well, you've used that language twice, the clobber text.
Sorry,
so,
yeah.
So for people who may not know what that means, what are you talking about when you say that?
Yes. So, and I got that phrase from someone else. So,
oh, sure. Yeah.
When they say six clobber passages, people are often referring to the six verses that refer to some kind of same-sex behavior in the Old and New Testament. So it's a couple verses that are in Leviticus, and then it's also the famous verse in Romans 1 and 1 Corinthians and 1 Timothy. These are the six times through all of Scripture that same-sex behavior or things like that are mentioned. So people often call them the six clobber passages because they're often like just thrown at people as ways of like rejecting LGBTQ people and not really engaging in the conversation.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start working through my questions a little bit, and I'm sure we'll trail off, and I'm sure they will make me think of other things I want to ask. I also want to say, please feel free to stop me and say, you know what, that makes me think about this, and this is, I want to share this. So, all right.
Okay,
so
okay.
You have kind of already, you've already explored this a little bit, but I'm still going to ask it because it may be phrased in a way that may make you think about adding to it. So what were some of the things that began to reveal to you that your spirituality was too small?
Yeah. And just so you know, I take some notes, so I may be looking down occasionally.
That is fine. Can I tell you, Amanda, let me tell you something. I think you were the only one so far to ask me, like, what are you going to ask me?
Oh, I'm glad I did, because you sent me these and I said, Megan, these are like second order questions. This isn't just something I could have just said off the top of my head.
Well, it's so funny. I thought, okay, that probably says a little bit about her. It also probably says something about the topic. So, that was just, so it was funny to me, and I was like, oh, okay. Now I usually do write out questions. I usually have them ready. Like I have them on, but I love that. It was just, it made me kind of laugh and made me think, yeah, this is, big stuff. So, okay. And I'm gonna let you answer.
Okay, great. So yeah, like I mentioned before, I went on the world race in 2012 to 2013. And I would say that for me, that journey was actually the tipping point of kind of this shift for me. Like you said, to reveal that my spirituality was too small. I think in some ways it was just me being away from home that gave me a different perspective on the worldview that I had inherited. There was a time and a space for questions and curiosities and for doubts to arise. And some of these had been brewing under the surface for a little while. Some of these arose out of my experiences that I had. So the first I would say is I went with an ecumenical Christian organization. So this was the first time when I was partnering and living life with Christians who grew up out of my specific denomination and faith tradition.
Yeah.
And so I was able to experience this wide variety of Christian tradition. That was the first time I'd really ever heard of like Christian liturgy or the fact that they were more like progressive faith communities. So just seeing that Christianity didn't mean this one thing.
That in itself is such a shocking experience. Forget to add the other countries. I mean,
yes.
You were getting it going and coming. I mean, that's, I remember encountering that, and it was, I don't know. It was liberating. But it was so fascinating to me because there was this sense in which I had been raised to think, even if it wasn't said explicitly, that we're the real kind of, we're the real deal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Oh, and I think that attitude in me carried over for a while. My teammates would probably say, oh, she still thought she was the real deal for a solid part of this trip.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
that would probably be an interesting, like, just retreat in itself. It's like, hey, you come and you're going to hang out with a bunch of Christians who are faithful people who follow Jesus, but don't think exactly like you. And we could do that here in America.
Yep. Yeah, we'll get on that, Amanda. We'll get on that.
Yeah. Yes, yes. I'm looking for a job, so that's perfect.
Okay.
But yeah, so just to learn that there was really this treasure chest of experiences from thousands of years that I had no idea was out there. All these different voices, some that have been silenced, and that's why I hadn't heard them, and all these things to explore. So that's when I was like, maybe I have just a small slice here, and there's a whole pie. But of course, I was also even more so deeply impacted by the communities and individuals that I had the opportunity of meeting all over the world. So many of them were just so hospitable to us, and we, as much as you can in a month, tried to form really genuine relationships. Mm-hmm. And like I said, there's several of them that I'm still in contact with today. But if I'm honest, there's a very picturesque, beautiful way that I can paint this year. Mm-hmm. And there were some really great memories, but there were also things for me that were really hard about this year that I had to confront. Because going into this, my mindset and approach, especially when it came to evangelizing, in hindsight, was rooted in a lot of theological arrogance.
Wow.
From the get-go.
Okay.
Like before we even had the time to get to know one another, before I would even arrive in one of these communities, I had already made my mind up that what I had to say was right. And that implicitly implied that what they thought that I didn't even know yet was wrong.
Right. What a powerful phrase or that terminology, theological arrogance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember thinking one day, oh my gosh, Amanda, you thought that God wasn't here, but until you arrived. Like, I literally thought, and that sounds, but I'm talking about myself. Like, yeah. My perception was, because the language we use is, I'm bringing the good news, right?
Right.
So it's this idea that it wasn't there until I got there.
Oh, my.
And that sounds crazy to me now, but, and I remember thinking, I'm pretty sure it was in, like, the African countries at the beginning of 2013, and I thought, Amanda, God was here.
Right.
Before you got here.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Of course, mm-hmm. Yes, there was still truth to be discovered in conversation.
Sure.
And can we even fathom that maybe there are some experiences that these people have had of the divine that you would be humbled to hear about?
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. And so it was really hard for me in some ways coming home because I had anticipated having these stories of converting the masses or of going out and doing this great work of evangelism in all these countries and communities that weren't Christian. But really, I got a big dose of humility.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
I was over in these places.
I love that you use that word, humility. In fact, when you said theological arrogance, I had the thought, right, like the cross-cultural experience, it does, that's another thing it builds in you. I think that it's coupled with the empathy is humility. It knocks you down. It knocks you down a few. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. It does.
Right. Wow. That's really powerful, Amanda. Thanks for saying all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I mean, one other thing that I'll share as I was kind of reflecting on this experience recently is I think one phrase that's become popular in the past couple of years is like other or like otherness.
Yeah.
Like someone other. And really, I mean, I do think that sharing the story of Jesus is important, right? I think we need to think about that and ask what are beautiful, ethical, uplifting ways of doing that.
Yeah.
And that's something to wrestle with. But it should never make anyone feel like I'm on the inside and this person's like on the outside.
Wow.
And that I'm inviting them in.
Yeah.
So that's what really happened for me is that I realized that was the dynamic. And I mean, a whole other conversation we could have is like power dynamics and evangelism and international mission trips. But I really longed for a space that was big enough for all of us. And that's not what it felt like.
Yeah. So I wondered, I mean, do you take, I mean, that language, that your spirituality was too small, would you, uh-huh. Does that language feel right to you in that question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I would say that it does.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you. So what have been some of the hardest vestiges from the spirituality of your upbringing to overcome? You're laughing already.
So within my Christian tradition, there was, which had a lot of great things in it, there was also a very strong emphasis on the fallenness and total depravity of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, growing up as a 6, 7, 8 year old, you don't have that language or awareness, but that's kind of what you're inheriting. That's just the water that you swim in, is this idea that because of this original sin of Adam and Eve, there's nothing good in humanity, there's nothing good in me. And I would say, for me, and I'm sure for many other people, that created a really unhealthy and negative relationship within myself. Because I believed that I could never trust my own thoughts, my own voice, my own experiences, let alone my own desires. I just think, I think it's a verse in Jeremiah that says, the heart is deceitful above all else.
You're reading my mind, Amanda. I'm just sitting here, I'm like, okay,
and
yeah.
I can't tell you how many times that verse was quoted to me.
Yeah.
Like, I would have a genuine thought or emotion or reaction, and it was like, sorry, man, the heart's deceitful. Nothing. I'm like, all right, okay.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I mean, and then it's kind of weird because you're also taught that you're created in the image of God. And so it's this weird,
right?
Like, back and forth kind of, where am I at today?
Yeah. Okay, I want to stop with that scripture. So how have you reconciled some of your, I mean, how do you relate to that verse now?
I don't know if I've tried that one yet. I mean, right, I do believe that the Bible has, and the sacred text, and these stories have really important things to say to us now. I mean, it's profound, some of the things that come out of Scripture that relate to the present moment. But at the same time, I also think we have to remember that there was an original author with an original context, with an original audience that they were thinking about. And honestly, to go and do that verse justice, I would have to go back and say, specifically, what was Jeremiah talking about, and who was he talking to?
Yeah.
And what makes sense? Like, once again, that question of moral logic. Why was Jeremiah saying this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's really important that we know why, because that's something that can transcend.
Right.
But that there's a lot of danger in just really plucking those, what, like 6, 7 words out and just applying it to anything and everything.
Right. Yeah, it can become such an absolute statement that just pretty much negates, it so conveniently negates anything anyone ever says. I mean, right? Sorry. I mean, you can just pull it out on a whim and just, yeah, you're wrong. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, it's kind of like the ultimate clapback, you know?
It is, right. And, I mean, but then, oh my gosh, right? But then you have, oh my gosh, but then God told me this, and God's, anyways, but yeah, so I think I've heard people talk about that verse in that sense too, that in terms of being spirit led and your heart being transformed, and that there is, you know, the work of grace and the work of the Spirit in your heart. And so, anyways, yeah. But I think the point, though, is, yeah, it's just one of these verses that people pull out to really instill a lot of doubt and a lot of insecurity in people that really becomes problematic. Yeah. And actually becomes antithetical to trusting and working with the voice of the Spirit in your life. Because then it's just, I mean, I've seen people just go kind of crazy with trying to figure it out. Like, is this me or is this God or that, you know, and it becomes really, really anxiety provoking and contributes to mental health problems too. Anyways. Okay. I'm going to stop now, Amanda. Okay. All right. Sorry. Where were you?
Oh yeah. No, you're totally fine. But yeah, I mean, so just going back to that is, because of this whole idea that I couldn't trust myself and that really I was my own worst enemy. I lived in the sphere that I was always wrong, that God was always disappointed in me, that, you know, yes, God loved me, but God probably didn't like me very much. And that there was always something I needed to fix about myself. And I feel like every time I had some type of quiet time or devotional, at least 50% of that was just me apologizing and apologizing, because even though I knew that as a Christian, I trusted that, you know, that Jesus was the intermediary for me and God, and that I had Jesus, I had grace and love from God, I still wanted to be enough, like as Amanda, you know, there was still some part of me that wanted to be loved for who I was. And I just felt like I had this scarlet letter that I can never get rid of. And like you were saying, it is this weird dynamic, because you as like, or myself as an individual, I'm told that you can't, I can't trust myself. But then often there's a leader or a group of leaders, and those are the people we are supposed to completely trust because their hearts are never deceitful. Sorry, I don't mean to take us back there.
It's okay. I'm just trying to calm myself down because I will just go off. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, yeah, we're so talking about power. It's a power dynamic, right?
It really is. It really is. So, yeah, so that's something that I would say is still really hard for me in learning to trust my own voice. And my own
not to mention that that group of leaders are usually males. But anyways, we were.
Right. Yes.
Right.
Very little in common.
Yeah.
My own experience.
Yeah. So. You know, I think it even reminds me of what we're kind of told, that like there's this language of God doesn't, once you're saved and you're washed with the blood and, you know, that all that language, that God doesn't see you anymore. He sees the cross.
Mm.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's so interesting. There's so much of this language that I haven't really been around or thought about in a long time, but
yeah, I think
that's one of them.
I mean, I really hope God does see me. I mean, and that, he's, you know, I believe he's big enough to see me and be with me. And
one other thing that just made me kind of mind is like, one of the things that makes me so passionate about the gospel and about the message of Jesus is that it's an incarnational message.
Right.
So what do we do with that? Like, what do we do with the fact that God became human?
Yeah.
And knows about this human experience and bore flesh and lived with us and among us. What does that say about the human experience? So, and I'll never forget, I was never at Renovatus when Jonathan Martin was there, but I heard several of his sermons. And the one where he talked about that he believes the blessing and the grace from God and the creation story would always be greater than any sort of blame or shame from what happened in Genesis 3 in the fall. And that was something that I really clung to.
Yeah.
Like believing that that blessing would always have more power.
Yeah. 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 I mean, the shaming piece really gets in the way of what we're also taught is that it's about a relationship. So, yeah, I mean, we're taught, that's what we're simultaneously taught too. This is about a relationship. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to be in a relationship with someone who doesn't see you. They see a cross and they don't. So just some of those messages. And I mean, I think as a child to hear that, those kind of words, I think just what it does to your psyche and how you think about yourself. So yeah, there's a lot there to really unpack. And oh, I know one thing I was thinking about, you said your trip, and you said that's really what made you start thinking about this whole other world out there, even within the Christian faith. I've heard it said before about some of these stories that like, it's like when you get away, there's almost this psychological space created for you to even be able to go there on, issues of like sexuality and different things. But when you're home or when you're in your, you know, bubble, it's like that's not even, it's almost like it's hard for it to even be an option. But then getting away, it kind of creates this room, and then you're able to kind of, you know, explore all of that. Is that kind of how it felt to you?
Yeah, I mean, that really makes sense. What's interesting is, for me, when I was overseas, wrestling with my own sexuality really wasn't even something that was on the front burner.
Yeah.
Because I was so amazed and constantly in awe of the newness of the places we were traveling and the things that we were doing, that really had a lot of my attention. Mm-hmm. And because of what we were involved in, it was a lot of Christian mission work. That's what gave way to these questions and curiosities and doubts, kind of about what we were actually physically doing in those spaces.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like once I got home, my own process and conversation about my sexuality wasn't far behind.
Yeah. The space was created.
Because there was a direct correlation in all of those.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So do you have anything else you wanted to add? I know we kind of went off in some different directions there.
Yeah. I mean, the only other thing I would say about something that's been difficult to overcome, and I'm not even sure if I would use the language of overcome, but maybe just work through, mm-hmm. is some of the grief that I have around this, like you said, the spirituality of my upbringing or my childhood faith community and what it feels like to not be as close or not be a part of that community anymore. Because there's a lot of deep emotional connections with those people and those experiences, even things like the worship music or the language that was used. Anytime I hear those things now, I definitely sense a real genuine spirit of grief.
Yeah.
Just because that was something that I've lost. And I mean, a lot of those people that I was close to still mean a lot to me. We just had very different experiences.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to kind of reconcile some of those, even as much as we try to do in relationship and showing one another grace. So there's a lot of security kind of in the spirituality of my upbringing. Black and white has some really things messed up about it, but it feels safe.
It sure does. Yeah.
So yeah, there's definitely some grief there that I feel like I'm still working through and that pops up sometimes more than others. So.
No, thank you for saying that, Amanda. I wonder if that grief maybe lessens over time and also kind of just stays with you and becomes part of your story, but the picture I'm getting is the space created in your heart for other people. So that grief kind of helps make that pain, maybe carves out some of that room that you use already, but also in ministry to others. And yeah, I think it's part of your home, right? And it's part of your DNA. And what I hear, your spiritual DNA, and one thing I hear in you is obviously deep respect and love for that community and a desire to still appreciate the good things that you got from them along the way too.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would say there's definitely a temptation, especially in just kind of our current climate, to say that's all bad, this is all good, or to demonize one thing or another. But that's, a lot of people have asked me, you know, how have you experienced like the presence of God in like the past couple of years? And I just really believe that in the midst of where I am and where my family or my childhood faith community is, that I trust that God's grace is in the midst of us and holding us, even when we don't exactly see eye to eye or we don't know how to relate to each other because things have changed, but that God's grace is still present in the midst of that. But yeah, there's definitely grief there, but I really do hope that I can continue to work through that and be present with it in a healthy way so it doesn't just like end in bitterness or in resentment.
I think that is such an admirable desire. And I could imagine that the pain would be so great too, that being around those people that you love dearly triggers that pain and anxiety and grief to the point where it would be so easy. There might be even days where it would feel healthier to and maybe there are seasons where you have to just say, right now, I can't, like for my mental health and emotional health, I just can't have contact with, I can't initiate that kind of contact because and I don't know. I feel like the onus is really almost on you, Amanda, to be able to hold a lot of those tensions more so than them. Would you say that's true?
I think so. I think just because I'm aware of them, like I carry them with me.
Yeah.
Because so much of the tension is about my own experience and what people see as my decision.
Right.
So, and it feels like that in a community that has, for the most part, stayed the same, I'm the one that's changed. So, yeah, I have a tendency to think about all the things I need to do to kind of stay in the good graces of other people and to still be accepted. So I've had to learn what it looks like for me to go 50, if that's what I need to do. But like you said, if I need to do something else to be healthier, to show a little bit more self-care, self-compassion, that I do with that. I do what's necessary. And then, like I said, whatever that space is where we aren't fully together just yet, trusting that God's grace is there with us, especially with those people like my family who have walked this journey with me, who have loved me unconditionally and are still showing up in every way they know how to.
That's amazing.
Even in the midst of still having a lot of questions and things that don't fully make sense to them.
Yeah. So if you don't mind, what's that been like coming out to your family? And if that's not something you want to talk about, that's fine.
Yeah. No, I think I can. So what's a really interesting dynamic within my story is that my parents, even before my sisters, knew about my same-sex attraction earlier on in my life. They had known for at least 7 years before I made the decision to come out. So in many ways, they were aware of this struggle that I had and were very present to kind of help support however they could. So being an oldest child, I like made up my own game plan of how I was going to handle my same-sex attraction. I had like, okay, these are steps I need to take and it will all be taken care of. Mom and dad, I just need like a checkbook for a couple of counselors and we'll be good to go. So they, unlike other family dynamics where it's really driven by the parents forcing their kids to try and change or get help, I actually went to my parents and asked them to financially support me going to counseling about being gay and how to not be gay. And yes,
you were going to take care of things, Amanda.
Oh yeah. It was, and that was my thing. I don't really want to talk about it because it's really vulnerable, embarrassing, but if you just trust me, it'll all be taken care of.
Wow. I got it. I handle it.
Yeah. And we see how that worked out.
Do you? Right. Do you? I'm totally okay. Are you into the Enneagram at all?
Yes.
What number are
you? I actually had it. I already had thought about how that would incorporate.
You're like, I know Emily's going to ask me. Or if she doesn't, I'm going to bring it up. Yeah.
Can you guess?
Oh gosh, Amanda, like I've got to be honest, like as I've listened to you, there's been a couple times that I was trying to guess, which I think is really sad. It probably says I have a problem. Okay.
I took a class at Wake on the spirituality of the Enneagram.
You took a whole class on it?
A whole semester.
You've got to teach me. Like, okay.
Well,
oh my gosh. I may need to have you back. I have a friend who he does lots of trainings and I've already asked him to do a podcast with me on the Enneagram. So I don't know.
It's a mutual friend. Maybe not. Probably not.
I don't know. Do you know Wesley Nichols? He's from, he's from Tennessee. He comes to Charlotte to get trained, but okay. Hang on. I'm going to think. Oh no, I'm not. Okay.
Also, Wake Div is about to start a podcast on the Enneagram. So
no way. Okay.
My professor.
With your professor. Okay. Will it be on the spirituality of it more? Like more
yes.
of that? Okay.
Yes.
Have you listened to The Road Back to You and all those?
I think I've heard that, but I actually haven't listened to that.
Oh, okay. So there is
a big podcast
person. Yeah, so. Me too. It's like a joke with my students, like almost every class. I'm like, so there's a podcast where they talk about this. Don't read any of your books. Just listen to podcasts as you drive around. So The Road Back to You is a book and it was written by Suzanne Stabile and Ian Cron. And they interview different numbers in the podcast each time.
That's awesome.
Yeah. There was one where they interviewed the number that my oldest daughter is, and I was by myself in the car, and I started laughing out loud. They interviewed Michael Gunger, and he's a five.
Okay.
And just listening to him, I was like, oh my gosh, you're my oldest daughter. Because they asked him, they said, they asked him a question and he was like, what do you mean by that? Like, what does that mean? And I was like, oh my gosh. All right, five. Okay. Okay. I'm going to get serious here. Okay. What do I think you are? So there's part of me that heard someone.
Okay.
And there's part of me that heard some four.
Huh?
With the whole just traveling around. I don't know, but that's kind of some seven too. But then you have some pretty strong leadership qualities. There might be some eight in there too. So now I'm just going to stop and let you tell me.
So I like all those, but none.
What? Are you a two?
No, I'm a three.
Oh, I should have guessed that, right? You're the achiever. Yeah.
I asked for the questions.
Yeah, you
I
did.
I have my sheets.
Okay. See, I'm not, I think I'm an expert, but I'm really not.
Also, no, but it's, I mean, there's so, when it's somebody's motivations,
yeah,
that's a lot harder than just like personality traits. So.
It is. Yeah, it is. Right. Okay. No,
and
I
so
see
for
that.
For me, actually, I mean, once I learned about the Enneagram and then I'm thinking about my story and my life in hindsight and wanting to be enough and wanting people's approval. And then you think about the intersection of like religion with that.
Oh yeah.
And kind of what I was talking about earlier about the strong emphasis on something's just always wrong with you. You're never good enough. So
yeah, you're all over that three. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. All right. What number do you know? What number do you think I am?
Oh gosh. See ya.
You're the one that took the class on it, Amanda. Of course. Now, I will say, you don't, you know, it's not like we've hung out a lot.
You're not supposed to type other people.
What?
Did you know that? You're not supposed to type other people.
Right, but you
didn't. It's self-typing.
It is. I know, but you asked me what your number was.
Okay. Either.
This is always so funny. Okay, I'm waiting.
Okay.
But you're right.
I'm going two or nine.
Two or nine. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I didn't get it right.
No. You didn't. But I will say, okay, so a lot of people guess a two. A lot of people do because, yeah, and there's definitely a lot of two. And Wesley at first thought I was a three. So
you've got me on the edge of my seat because you're not like revealing it.
Right. So I'm an oldest, like I'm the oldest child too. Like, so, and I'm very, like, you should have seen me in high school, I mean, in college, it was ridiculous. Like I mean, just always doing. I have my list. Yeah. I'm going to take care of things too. And okay. So right now I'm actually kind of in this space where I'm kind of like, just F the Enneagram, right? I'm kind of mad at it because I've just decided I don't know. But I'll tell you what it seemed like I am and what I have gotten feedback from him and others. And I know, and it's what I thought too, a four wing three.
Okay.
Yeah.
My
three wing's super strong though. I've got a lot of three and two, but fours when they're stressed, look like twos, right? They can become unhealthy twos. So, and then
I think it's ones.
No,
don't they go to ones.
They go to ones when they're healthy, like when they're balanced.
No, so when they're stressed, and they go to seven.
No, not fours. No,
I think so.
No, I'm looking this up right now. I'm looking it up right now
because they're separated by twos.
Okay. No, if you say seven, that will make a lot of sense. Like, I actually kind of hope you're right. Because I will feel like I have a lot.
Yeah.
What?
I'm right.
No, I'm looking at it. No, wait. Amanda, See, the four, yeah, they go up to one, and then they go over to two. Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I have told so many people the wrong thing.
Right.
You know why? Because, see, you see how mine is 3, 6, 9?
Yep.
I thought all of them formed triangles.
Oh, right.
That's why I always thought there was a two space. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have doubted you.
Well, no. I mean, it is self-typing, Amanda. So Okay. But have you done any work? We're totally off on the trail right now, but I still want to ask. Do you get into like the tri-types and stuff? And have you heard of tri-types?
Is that like heart, mind, body?
Yeah. It's like having your strong number in each one, like what your strong number is. And then if you have the three, then they each tri-type has a title. Like they have when I start doing that stuff, I'm just like, that's just too much. Like you.
Yeah. I feel like I know like I'm a three with a two wing.
Okay.
And then I have.
That makes sense.
Like my stressor and my strength or security points. And then discovering that I was a heart type, like kind of blew my own mind, but.
Why?
Well, no, I mean, I understand why I'm a heart type, but I'm not quick to access my emotions a lot.
Okay.
And I think that's for almost like self-preservation reasons, like over the years, like, I'm going to shut this off. I'm okay. We're okay.
Yeah.
So learning how.
Because you got to get things done. You've got to take care of things, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have time for that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but it is true that my heart is a place that I can really like live from and engage with people with. And there's a lot of like.
Yeah, you can tell.
There.
But. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I just kind of live in that heart triad. Just all over the two, three, and fours. I'm just all over there. Okay. All right. We'll leave the Enneagram discussion. Have you seen that video that makes fun of that? I posted it on, I think I posted it on Twitter. It is the funniest thing. Have you seen it? Where that guy, oh my gosh, I'm sending it to you. It totally makes fun of everything we just did. It's really funny. Okay. All right. Next question. What have been the biggest surprises in your shifting spirituality?
Biggest surprises. The biggest thing that kind of goes in contrast with what, like, I just talked about as something that's been really difficult for me to overcome is this newfound freedom that I've discovered that is so true and deep, and it's almost like this image of like a huge open field I can just run in, because I'm no longer living in fear. I'm no longer living with this constant burden, always thinking I'm not good enough. And just the freedom to be honest, like every day I can be honest with myself, with other people, with God about my questions or my thoughts or my doubts. And within that freedom, viewing my own voice as a valid conversation partner with questions about life and as I'm studying theology at Wake, and that I actually have something to offer and to be a part of in this conversation, you know, and that God can handle whatever I throw at God.
Yeah.
That God's not intimidated by what I have to bring and like the fullness of who I am.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. No, that's really beautiful. And I think so honest too, that freedom, it's scary. And it's almost shocking to your system. Uh-huh. And that's not to say that there isn't such a thing as boundaries and healthy living and wisdom and all of that. That's found in the freedom, right? And that's found in learning to, in a very healthy way, trust yourself so that you can have trusting relationships with others and with God, right? So, yeah, I feel like the freedom actually leads you to be more honest and authentic and not do so much hiding that really contributes to so many of the things that get preached against. But anyways.
Right.
Yeah.
But no, and I mean, I would say that freedom is definitely still held by God. Like, I still completely feel in God's presence as I'm experiencing that freedom.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I mean, it is a real thing that I feel and I'm thankful for every single day. And it's a freedom, and I am thankful that I'm able to voice where I am. But that's not because I'm a seminary student or because I work at a church, and so now I have these things to contribute and say. But it's because I believe that we all have something to share and contribute based on our own life experiences and stories to tell. things to teach other people. So,
yeah. Lots of depth there, Amanda. I love it. So, okay. So where have your greatest sources of support come from? And I guess that question is, maybe we can make it broad, but we can also make it specific to this discussion. So your greatest support, as you've navigated these waters, this journey, and as you continue to, cause you've talked about the grief over losing really so much. I've heard it said you have to replace it. Like there has to be the building of a new community, or you won't make it.
Yep. No, that's super. That's definitely true. And I would say that I have communal support and then I also have individual support, and both of those things are necessary.
Okay. Can you say more? Like, what do you mean? Like maybe some examples?
Yeah. No, of course. I've had the privilege of being a part of a lot of beautiful and grace-filled communities, many of those faith communities, like Renovatus Church. That was, even though I was only there for like 8 months, to have a community that welcomed me wherever I was from week to week, because there was no telling where I was on this Sunday was completely different than the next Sunday. But also Wake Divinity has been an amazing school. They're affirming of LGBTQ students, and I knew that when I applied.
I'm so glad you're there. Yeah, really glad.
And so to the place where I'm studying theology and training to be a religious leader, one, to be affirmed and in that part of my identity and calling, but then two, just to get to study theology like everybody else, mm-hmm. you know, and not have it be a big deal.
Right.
I just get to show up as me and study Greek just like all the straight people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not that big of a deal. But
not that big of a deal. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and yeah, like we named the Reformation Project earlier, was an awesome community to be a part of. The church that I go to here in town in Greensboro, First Christian Church. So all of those communities, I mean, I have those all over the place.
Okay.
And I'm thankful to be a part of those. So those have been huge support systems. And then as individuals, it's great to be able to walk into a space where you're welcomed and accepted and loved and supported. But then you also sometimes just want to pick up the phone or say, can we grab dinner and have that kind of one-on-one support. So I've had so many individuals and mentors from each of these places. There was a third year student when I started my first year at Wake who was a gay woman, a couple years older than me. And she's become just a really great mentor and source of encouragement. And if I'm having a hard day, I can call her. And she reminds me of who I am and that I'm loved and that I'm enough. So having those individual sources of support. And I would also say my family, like I mentioned earlier, they still, I think, wrestle with what it means to have a gay daughter and a gay sister, especially one who's a Christian and wants to be ordained. Like no one expects that. But they are always present. They are always willing to listen and hear my stories and the new things that I'm learning and tell me over and over that they are in my corner and they are a cheerleader. And so just them in their own way saying yes to being a part of this journey. I think I live in tension because sometimes I have people who say, like, your family should be more affirming and, you know, be willing just to stand out there in the streets and advocate for LGBTQ people or be willing to stand up to other people and things that they say. And I get that and I understand. And, of course, I would want that. That's a hope of mine one day. But we have to remember where people start from and the context that my parents were raised in and everything that my sisters knew to be true until their own sister came out, and show grace for where people are on their journey.
Yeah.
So they're really important. And then, of course, the best for last is my fiance, Megan. So weird. She was my girlfriend for 3 years, and now she's my fiance. But she
I noticed there's a big smile when you say that.
Yes, a big smile. But we've actually known each other since 2009.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're really good friends. So she's been on this journey with me. She knows my heart. And really, no matter what I'm wrestling with, she's really helped me to stay grounded, reminding me of who I am and really just encouraging me to trust the journey. So I couldn't have done it without anybody that I just named. So I'm really, really thankful.
That's great. It sounds like you've got a really solid support system. And that's really beautiful to hear about how your family is walking with you, too. That's really nice. Really great. So are there any things from the spirituality of your upbringing that have actually helped you on your journey?
So my childhood faith community, they are the ones who really nourished the beginning of my relationship with Christ and who taught me a lot of the gospel truths that I still hold on to this day. Knowing about God's love, the importance of loving others, of treating others the way you want to be treated, serving others, especially people who are in need. I really believe that I have the deep roots that I have in the Christian faith today because of their investment and their love and care for me. One of the most powerful things for me about the Christian faith is this belief in the intimate presence of God and that God is always with us. And even this idea of an incarnational God, that God is in the flesh and God is not far off, but is in the trenches with us. Yeah. And that truth is actually what gave me a lot of the comfort and strength throughout my own journey the past couple of years. I would also say that the Southern Baptists are really good at teaching the Bible.
Yeah, they are.
And there may be some things we can argue about what they teach or how they teach it, but I knew my Bible really well, like thanks to this congregation. And I feel like a lot of faith communities now are wrestling with how do we teach Scripture in an age where there isn't traditional Sunday school anymore and all these other questions. Mm-hmm. How do we pass down these stories that are really important to the Christian tradition? But thanks to my church and VBS and all those things, I know my Bible, and it really helps when I'm wrestling with the text and when I'm asking questions of the text, and it gives me something to ground myself in.
Absolutely.
And it makes me so many different experiences. So I'm really thankful for that.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned that, the whole concept of biblical literacy, right? Or illiteracy versus illiteracy. I mean, just being able to have those stories be part of your narrative is so, it gives you, it's so powerful. It gives you kind of this framework for really understanding life. That actually is really what, means so much to me is really the stories. It's just the stories that I had taught to me over and over again. What would you tell someone who is just beginning the type of transition that you have made?
So actually one thing, there's a quote that I had a friend give to me or pass along at the beginning of my journey that I have clung to literally the entire way. And most people are probably familiar with it, but I just want to read it. It's by Rainer Marie Rilke. And he says, "Be patient toward all that is unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves. Like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given to you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. So live the questions now. Perhaps you would then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer."
That's so beautiful. Yeah, I love that poetry.
And so that quote is what I would really pass along and have passed along to a lot of other people who have similar stories to my own, is encouraging them to be present to the moment, to be honest with themselves, honest with God, and to not try and rush this process. Because it's a very sacred and sensitive journey, and really every step of the way deserves the most care and grace that you can give yourself and give other people. Another thing I would tell someone is that their voice and their experiences and their intuition are sacred sources, that they are things that should be listened to and things that should be treasured. And doubts or questions that they have, they shouldn't be afraid of those things. Like I said earlier, God is not afraid by our questions or intimidated by our thoughts. So to practice being courageous and vulnerable in that way. Then I think something else is super important, and that's kind of trendy right now, but it's still real, is to encourage other people to practice self-care and self-compassion. Honestly, going through this process and in many ways reimagining what life can look like is exhausting and emotionally draining. So like we talked about earlier, what are the boundaries that you need to set up when you sense this temptation that you need to have everything figured out, how can you show yourself patience and grace and be realistic in that moment about what you need?
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I love the emphasis on valuing the questions and the doubt themselves. Uh-huh. I think so often people are scared of them, particularly in certain parts of their journey or in certain traditions, and really they're usually the vehicle for faith development and growth. So
I will never forget, because I mean, if I'm honest, I mean, there were a couple times when and this scared me to death, I didn't know if I was going to be a Christian in a week or in 2 weeks or in a month. I had no idea where this trajectory was headed. But when I discovered that when God gave Jacob the name Israel, and that the name, the Hebrew meaning of behind Israel was to wrestle. Mm-hmm. And that wrestling with the text, that wrestling with God was a treasured part of the Jewish faith tradition.
Yeah.
I mean, that nugget of what was enough for like a year that I could live off of and really say there's a place for me in this tradition.
Yeah.
That an important part of faithfulness and relationship with God is wrestling.
Yeah.
So that's something that's good news that I love to share all the time.
Yeah. Nice. I love that you shared it here. So, so good. So looking back, what would you, are there anything, is there anything you would do differently?
As an Enneagram type 3, I think I would try my best to care a little bit less about what other people thought.
I got a strong 3 wing, Amanda. I get ya. Yeah, I get ya.
Well, because of all the communities I've been a part of, all the relationships that I've had, many of which have been in the context of Christian communities, mm-hmm. I was constantly worried about what other people were thinking. Mm-hmm. As I was being more honest about questions that I had within our faith or wrestling with the decision to come out, I really felt a lot of the expectations of who I was supposed to be or the box I was supposed to fit in. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could have kind of let that go a little bit more. In some ways, I like to think that I did the best I can, and sometimes we just have to, that's all we can do.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, I know I've been watching from a distance, and I remember your blog post that came out, and then I remember you announcing your engagement not too long ago, and I just have been so impressed with how steady you've been and how gracious and unwavering and non-combative, but strong and rooted. So I don't know. I don't see everything, but that's the sense I get. So, yeah. And I wonder if one of the reasons why I sense that is you've obviously done a lot of thinking and work and in intentional wrestling, even before any of us saw any of that. So
you
had already done all this internal work that I know is ongoing, but it was already there. A lot of that work had already been done. So what makes you most proud or proudest at this point in your journey?
Once again, it's kind of like a really simple answer, but to me it's also profound at the same time. Just the fact that I am living my truth, that blows my mind. Because for so long I thought this was impossible. I couldn't see a straight path from where I was as a young girl to now. Mm-hmm. And so just the fact that I am living my truth as a gay Christian woman in a relationship about to get married to someone that I love, that blows my mind. And I mean, there are some days when I look back and have random memories of all the small steps that like brought me here. And, I really just can't believe it. So I am. I'm proud of myself. I'm thankful for the people who've been with me on this journey. I'm thankful for God's strength that has sustained me. So, we're here. It's fruit of a lot of labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that, fruit of a lot of labor. And honestly, like sitting here listening to you, what just came to my mind was how healthy you sound, Amanda. Like, I know you're probably exhausted in finishing seminary. So there's that aspect of health. And yeah, you sound like you're living in the light, right? You sound like you're not hidden. You're living with this authenticity and realness and there's this congruency through your life. So it feels healthy to me. And does that resonate with you? I mean, do you feel that way?
Yeah, no, I would say I do for the most part. I mean, there are definitely things that I continue to work through.
You're not perfect. You're three, right?
No, I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect. But I would say the healthiness, like you're saying, hasn't come without putting in a lot of work. I'll have conversations with people about my journey, and they can just tell I've processed it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, like, mm-hmm. I kind of have it down to, I can get you through all the highlights in about 7 minutes.
You got your elevator speech ready.
And I also think, and this kind of goes back to any advice I would give someone else, me and another one of my friends at the Vineyard School call ourselves therapy evangelist, because we love our therapist. And I actually asked my therapist if she could come be my therapist of honor at my wedding. But we would not be here without you. I mean, really investing in finding someone that can help you do this work in a very intentional way. I mean, friendships are great, and I wouldn't be here without my community. Yeah. But a therapist is a different kind of relationship, as you obviously know, where you have this very intentional time to mm-hmm. talk about whatever you need to talk about. And yeah. I've had a lot of aha moments sitting in many chairs and on many couches that I think I've had it ongoing, which I think has contributed to the health that I have today.
I love that. That's great. Now, your therapist, do you know what her training and her background is? Does she have theological or spirituality training?
No, she doesn't. I've had some who have. Mm-hmm. So I've had some that have had training. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be honest, after going and seeing like 9 biblical counselors.
No. I did not say biblical counselors.
I know you didn't. Okay, yes. You do need to name that there is a huge difference. There is mm-hmm. a huge difference that the entire world needs to be educated on.
Yeah. I mean,
but man, after a while, I was like,
no. I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sure they help people. Oh, gosh. I'm probably going to edit this whole section out. No. Now, listen, okay, so I am a therapist who's also a Christian, and I don't know, I mean, and then there's people who would, it's just nuanced, but they would more likely say I'm a Christian therapist. So part of my training involves spirituality and theology, and so that's something that I can cite as being something that I love to work with in the room. But it doesn't matter where you are in your journey to me. I love right. talking and being able to make room for those kind of conversations, which is very different than the other. So anyways, which I'm sure they do too.
I didn't mean to.
No.
Light that flame.
I'm the one that asked the question because I was curious what her background was. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, honestly, I see her little degree in the law every time I sit in there. And I've only been with this one for about a year and a half.
Okay.
Because my other one moved. So, yeah, and one random story, and you can decide what to do with it. But I was actually the last quote-unquote biblical counselor that I saw was in Charlotte. Like, a little bit overlapping with the time that I was in going to Renovatus. And I'll never forget, she told me, when I started having feelings for Megan, a literal line was that like Satan was deceiving me, which I'm like, I think there's only one Satan. And if he's going after me, like that kind of blows my mind. But it was so interesting because I like talk about wrestling, my counseling sessions with her, I would wrestle with her. Like she did not sign up for that, but she was literally like my punching bag. Like when I was coming to terms with like, no, this actually isn't right.
Yeah.
And she would have to listen to me kind of process and be like, I've heard other things that are true and make much more sense and have led to much more life-giving outcomes for these people, to the point that towards the end, she didn't know what to say to me. And so I just kind of stopped seeing her, but I felt bad because, you know, we'd been so invested in one another's lives. So I wrote her a note and said, you know, we don't see eye to eye, so I don't think this is really healthy for me, but I'm really thankful for getting to know you and whatever. I don't know why I did that.
Yeah.
She said horrible things. She then, like, wrote me an email that said how, like, her walking with me had, like, changed her. And that she still really didn't know what to think or what to do, but she hadn't ever been with someone who was so committed to walking this journey and being faithful Christian, but also felt like this was such an intimate, important part of, like, who they were and their mm-hmm. sacred identity. And in turn, kind of, like, thanked me for our relationship.
Yeah.
So that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad you shared that. And I think I could see how, okay, first I just want to say I'm really sorry you had to hear those things. Really, really sorry. And I think I found myself thinking, wow, maybe there was a sense in which you needed to do that in a room with someone that had said those things. So anyways,
Yeah.
Okay. How do you manage the continuing voices, scripts that you have rejected, but still sometimes kind of come up, kind of rear their heads in your,
So
in your dialogue?
I feel like those kind of things come up in mainly two different ways. They either come up because of the environment that I'm in.
Okay.
That is in some way triggering, or they come up just internally.
Okay.
Within myself. So there are definitely certain environments that trigger voices of shame or fear or rejection. And so I'm just really intentional now about the times I enter these environments and how long I'm there, or the amount of time I engage in certain relationships and where I draw lines. So I just have boundaries with those things.
Yeah.
I would say internally, you know, the more and more you kind of surround yourself with people who are life-giving and who are speaking your identity of belovedness over you and who are accepting you just as you are, those things actually come up a lot less. So at least they have for me. Definitely 2-3 years ago, it was much more frequent for me to kind of hear those scripts playing in my mind.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you get to a point where you've replaced the soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, you now have different narratives that you can insert in the conversation.
That's powerful. I mean, that's huge. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, for many LGBTQ Christians, like, we have to almost relearn the Christian story and the Christian narrative in ways that affirm who we are and that say there's a place for us. So it's really important that when one of these scripts or voices go in my head, that I have that narrative I can tell myself that I've learned, or have someone else who can help me remember that and be in a community where I can be honest and accepted and loved. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Thank you. So what would you want to say to someone from the spirituality of your upbringing that rejects your sexuality and or the journey that you have taken? Right now, I guess. You probably wanted to say different things at different points.
So I have a good amount to say on this one, if that's okay. And you can decide what is best. Because I don't get to say this very often.
Oh, I'm so glad I'm giving you room to say it, Amanda.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just going to sit back. I'm going to get my popcorn. Hang on. I'm just kidding. Y'all want to hear.
So I've had many conversations over the past few years with friends, colleagues, family members who don't agree. And with many of them, I have asked one simple question while we're having that conversation, which is, what do you think I should do?
Wow.
And so far, 100% of the time, their response is, I don't know.
Wow.
And in some ways, I'm open and thankful for that response because they're not rushing to judgment or condemnation or trying to tell me what to do with something they don't really understand.
Yeah.
But there's another part of me that, if I'm honest, kind of feels like that answer is a little bit lazy. Because there are people like me who don't have the privilege of living in I don't know. And so we've had to do work, a lot of work. I heard someone say, Julie Rogers, who is a leading lesbian Christian voice, who I really look up to, she said, for all the LGBTQ Christians who've come to a place of affirming their identity, we should all receive honorary PhDs, because we've all just had to do so much groundwork to get to the point that we are. But I really do think that many people feel this way, this whole I don't know answer. You know, they don't think I should live my life out in the way that I am, but they also don't have an alternative for me. So, and after years and years, you know, we finally decided that reparative therapy doesn't work, thankfully. We've all reached that conclusion. And there are some people right now that have kind of hopped on the celibacy train. But many biblical scholars are saying that to demand for all of LGBTQ people to be celibate doesn't at all align with a historical or biblical understanding of what the purpose of celibacy. So like I said, there's a part of me that wants more from these individuals who say, I don't know. Because right now we have LGBTQ youth who are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide, experience suicidal thoughts, engage in self-harm than straight cisgendered youth. We have LGBTQ kids who are raised in homes who reject them and reject their identity. And those kids are 8.4 times more likely to have attempted suicide than someone who's accepted by their family. So youth who are rejected by their families, and which are often for religious reasons, are 34 times more likely to attempt suicide than a heterosexual cisgender kid. So for that to be the reality, and then for there to be little work sometimes by other people of not know, okay, what is our response to this community, to these kids? What is the church's response? How much more bad fruit, how much more death, self-harm, violence has to take place before we say maybe we got something wrong?
Right, right.
And one thing that I often say is, if you just take one church history class, you will learn pretty quickly that the church has got it wrong a couple times before now. Right. We often, in just our life period, aren't aware.
Yeah.
Of all the things that have come before us when we thought we knew we were talking about an experience, and sometimes a lot of trauma had to teach us otherwise.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is that to the people who reject my sexuality or my story is I'm really interested in the why behind people's answers, because I know for many of the people I've had conversations with, they'll just cite scripture as their main source, kind of like we were talking clobber text, and that ends the conversation. But I would really encourage people to take time to go a little bit deeper and ask if there are other reasons for why they reject my story and my journey. Is there something that just bothers you about it? And so one thing that I've thought of, I don't know if I've ever asked anyone this, but how would it make someone feel if they found out, if they were able to read the future and found out that LGBTQ people were included, affirmed, and even celebrated in the kingdom of heaven? And, like, that's how it turns out. And if there's something that when you hear that, it makes you angry, it makes you disgusted, it bothers you, then I think there might be something going on inside of you that's more than just, oh, well, the Bible says it's wrong. I think there's some fear of, well, that leads to more questions, and that doesn't make sense to me, or it's something different, there's a need to be right, or there may even be, like, some actual, like, homophobia or disgust around same-sex relationships that I'm not shaming you about, but I'm just saying, is it more of that? Is that actually maybe more of the root of your rejection of my story, but scripture is just a really kind of easy thing to say? So the last thing I'll say about this is, for me, I always come back to Jesus's story parable in Matthew when he's talking about the trees and their fruit. And he's actually talking about this in context of prophets and being able to tell who's a true prophet, who's a false prophet. But Jesus essentially says, you can tell a tree by its fruit. If there's good fruit, it's a prophet, or if it's a good tree, if it's bad fruit. And as we're looking at the effects, some of the stats that I just read of not affirming LGBTQ people, those have been overwhelmingly negative. It's led to countless amount of shame, suicide, violence, death, people being kicked out, outcasted of communities. But the statistics that have been coming out since same-sex marriage has been passed, since more and more people are able to be accepted in their religious communities, it's becoming more families are learning how to accept their sons and daughters and queer children, we see that suicide rates are going down. We see that struggle with mental illness and struggle with substance abuse and bullying at school, those things are going down. Mm. So for me, using this analogy that Jesus does of look at the fruit on the tree, it shows me that the good fruit comes from accepting and loving and welcoming LGBTQ people. And we even see positive fruit in the lives of LGBTQ people.
I was actually going to add that. Yeah, if you, that's, yeah.
Yeah, you talk about the fruit of the spirit, like love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity.
Yeah.
We have several queer faculty at Wake Div, and the way they just offer pastoral care and worship leadership, I'm like, how can anyone deny that the Holy Spirit is in this professor? You know, so.
Yeah, and I guess another thing I was thinking along those lines is, all the fruit that I see in you, Amanda. Yeah. Yeah. So, thank you. That's really powerful. And I'm really grateful that you put so much thought into sharing that last piece. It's, you shared some really important things for people to consider. So I also find you to be incredibly brave and vulnerable, and courageous with your vulnerability. And there's obviously a lot of wisdom there too. And so I'm so impressed with you. So impressed. So, okay. So I want to ask you, a couple other questions just to get to know you even a little bit more now that I've asked you all those other ones. Okay. So what are you going to do when you graduate and get married? Are you tired of that question yet?
No, I'm ready for an answer. I'm ready for somebody.
I don't have an answer. Yeah.
So that is something that I am just kind of taking a day at a time, applying to a lot of different positions.
Okay.
I'm currently in the ordination process with the Disciples of Christ.
Awesome.
Denomination, which is a great group of people, an awesome history.
I was going to ask you that next, where you were getting ordained. I didn't know if it was there or UCC. I wasn't sure where you were. Yeah. Yeah.
And Disciples of UCC, they like split. Now they're about to come back together. So
really? I didn't know they were about to come back together. Okay, cool.
I think they're in talks. Right now they have dual alignment. So if you're ordained in one, you can like preach in the other.
Okay.
So I'm really interested right now in nonprofit work, and maybe a faith-based nonprofit. That business side that I talked about, I love logistics and operations and making things happen. So there's a part of me, that would love to work with an organization that is caring for vulnerable populations in the Raleigh area that's working for shared equity for all people. So, whenever I see a job opening, I'm just sending my resume and seeing what's next. So there's a chance that I might land in some type of congregational position. But even though the Disciples of Christ nationally is affirming of LGBTQ people, it still is up to individual congregations, just like most denominations are now. It's still up to individual congregations to decide if they will call or hire an LGBTQ person. So I'm not sure how many opportunities I'll have for that in North Carolina in 2018, but hopefully more in the future.
Yeah. I've heard that for the UCC and the Disciples of Christ that in North Carolina, it's a more conservative area. So, yeah. So where does Megan live?
Megan lives in Raleigh, which is where we will live.
Okay. All right. That's what I was wondering. Where is she? Okay. Okay. Right. Raleigh. Right. Okay. So, all right. I'm trying to play. Okay. So this is kind of very off topic, but are you going to the Y Christian Conference?
Yes.
Yay. Me too. Me too.
I'm really excited.
Me too. I went to the very first one in Minnesota. Do you remember Emily Zimmer?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So she's the first person I interviewed.
I heard her podcast.
Yeah. So she and I flew out to Minneapolis for the first one, and it was just so beautiful. And then the one in Chicago I missed, which I hate, but the one in, you know, it's going to be at Duke. I was like, oh my gosh, like I have to go because it's right here. So Emily, remember Sarah Henderson?
Yep.
Good. So, okay, Sarah. And then do you remember Dana Dimmock? She came.
That name sounds a little more familiar.
Okay. Well, we are all for, I think we're going to drive together. So I'm really excited.
That's super fun.
Yeah.
I can just tell there's going to be a lot of people there that I know from so many different worlds and probably even more surprises. And I've never been. I've only watched, I've done, the live stream and watched from afar. So, you said, being a Duke had to go.
Oh, my gosh, right? And, I mean, I'm sure is it going to be in the cathedral there?
I would think so, because it's beautiful and huge.
Right? Oh, they had it in such a beautiful location in Minneapolis. And the last service was just stunning, the liturgy. And they included, a lot of the people from the Emily and I both got to participate, too. So they had, Nadia just came out and started handing out assignments. And we happened to be there. And so she just handed one to Emily and to me. And I was like, okay, sure.
Whatever you need.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Are you?
Yeah, it's cool because I feel like I can invite. There's so many people that I couldn't invite to a Christian conference, or traditional Christian conference. Yeah. But I think they will be so drawn to the authenticity of this and the realness of this. And
Yeah. Yes. Okay, that makes me think of, I'm wearing my Wild Goose Festival hat. Have you been to that?
Yes.
The Wild Goose Festival?
I have not.
Okay. All right. You going to go this year?
So, I don't know if you're going to post this or not. I've heard mixed reviews.
Okay. No, tell me. Okay.
Is that okay to say?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I want to hear what the mixed reviews are. So I wonder if it's anything I've heard.
I've just heard that for some of my more mainline friends, it's a really evangelical kind of feel and gig to it. Now, and that's not a good or bad thing.
That's very interesting that they feel that way. Okay. No.
If you were no way. They would categorize it as progressive evangelical.
Wow. Okay. Okay. I'm trying to figure out.
This is why you don't just take one person's opinion.
Right. Okay. I'm trying to figure out which part they experienced that way. Because I'm sure, there were different parts. If you just went to, the main stage, some of the church service-y kind of things, the music. I mean, I actually heard a couple people say it was kind of triggering for them because of the kind of music they were playing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I've heard that. Now, the different various tents where they have all the different speakers, anyways.
They were 100% talking about main stage, specifically worship.
Yeah. Okay. I heard that too. Yeah. I heard that.
And the other thing that I've heard is that it's a lot of white people.
Yes, I've heard this too, right? So it's all about justice and the arts and all this stuff. And I have a friend. I better not say who. So I have a friend here who is very involved in that kind of, justice and different communities. And she was like, I've went, but it's just, it's a bunch of white people and I don't really want to go.
And I think one thing that my friend actually brought up who went is actually curious if the location of Wild Goose Festival is a justice issue.
Wow.
Because you think about accessibility to that space and all these other things, who can get there? Who can take that time off? Who can make that journey?
I can barely get there, right? Your Wi-Fi literally goes out. And if you don't know, the last little part of the journey, it's just blind trust. I hopefully am going to make it because I don't know where I'm going.
What if they had at least another type of something in a more urban space that was much more accessible, easier for people to get to?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was at the pool one time and I was trying to explain it to some people and my daughter who'd been just interrupted me. She's 14. She was 13 then. She's like, it's a Christian Woodstock.
I think that's pretty.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty close.
I am going back this year. Jen Hatmaker is going to be there. And I think, I think it'll be good. And
I need to look at the dates.
Yeah. It's in July. It's in July. So
Hot Springs.
Mm-hmm. And it is, it's interesting and I like going, but I hear all of those critiques and understand them. So,
and I've never been, so those are just things I've heard. So we'll see.
No, they're valid. Someday. They're valid. Definitely. Especially.
Is Jen Hatmaker going to be Y Christian or no?
No, she's not on the list for Y Christian that I've seen. Okay. Yeah. No, I looked at the list and I follow a few of them on Twitter, but I know Rachel and, Nadia will be there, but okay. Oh, last thing I want to know, what do you like? What do you do? You mentioned self-care. What do you do for self-care, Amanda?
So, one of the things that I've gotten into the past year that I love is hot yoga.
Oh, okay.
And I will be honest, 45 minutes into that, I hate myself. I hate life. I have, like, little visuals of me running out the room and screaming at the top of my lungs. So, for me, it isn't this, like, picturesque thing. But it's really good for me in reconnecting with my body, because I feel like there have been so many years of me, like, saying body bad. I hate body. I mean,
yes.
That's a whole other podcast of, like, flesh spirit within Christianity. But it allows me to reconnect with my body, and it's really good for you. But also, it has a great space for, like, mindfulness and just, like, being present with yourself.
Yeah. I've done hot yoga once, and I don't know. Yeah. Yes. So, you get really hot. You get really hot. And there's something about that is, in itself, challenging. There's something about, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I actually went this past Saturday. A friend of mine is getting trained, and she needed people to, like, volunteer for her to kind of do her practice on. And so I had this private yoga session for an hour. Oh, Reese. Reese was one of my former, I interviewed her too.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, that sounds so familiar.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's a therapist too, and she's getting certified as a yoga instructor, and yeah, she's great. So, but yes, I think, and I love that you mentioned that about connecting with your body, especially maybe even particularly for LGBTQ community, because of what they are told about their bodies. Right. So, okay. The other thing so what else do you, do anything else do you do for self-care?
For me, self-care is individual and communal.
Mm-hmm.
So we have chapel twice a week at Lake Div. And while that is technically at school, to be a part of that service with my community twice a week, and then to go and we have community lunch after chapel every time they feed us, which is awesome. That is so much care for my soul.
Yeah.
Just to be able to have that time to go and sing songs together and to hear either one of my classmates or a guest speaker share some reflections on God's word, and then share a meal together. I try and make that a priority throughout my week in the midst of craziness. And the last thing I'll say for self-care is I commute to the church that I work at. It's about 30, 35 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
And I will often do that drive in silence.
Wow.
Because being in the car for me is one of the few places where I can't do something and get it done and multitask. Hopefully I'm not multitasking. Hopefully other people aren't. It's definitely a temptation. But I try and use that as an intentional time for me to disconnect and be present with myself and maybe pray. So that's a priority too.
Okay. All right. I'm really about to let you go. I have just a couple more related questions. So what are you mentioned podcasts. I guess I want to know if there's any podcasts you would recommend on or off topic. And if you watch and have any shows you recommend.
That's so fun.
Mm-hmm. I like getting recommendations.
So one that I'm listening to right now that I would highly recommend is the name of the podcast is Seen on Radio.
Okay. I haven't heard of that.
Wow. That's impressive. And it is from, let's see, I think they're based in the Center for Documentary Studies somewhere.
Okay.
But they have a season or whatever you call it on seeing whiteness.
Wow. Okay.
And they kind of talk about how often in our discussion of race relations or things that any of that topic, the focus is on people of color and it's on the experiences of people of color, which that's important. But what that does is we often don't interrogate whiteness and what that actually means and how whiteness was cultivated. And so I'm really, really enjoying that.
Okay.
So seen on radio.
Seen
whiteness.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Are they really long? Or are they,
They're like 30 minutes each.
Okay. That's
great. Which is nice because it's not a huge investment.
If they're really long, like the liturgist gets really long and I just have to listen. There's been, a few that I like of theirs and I just have to listen to like 30 minutes at a time or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm a huge, of course, On Being fan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, I occasionally, do some little murder mystery ones.
Okay. Like, oh gosh, what's one that was really popular? What was that one?
Yep, and that was like the first one I listened to.
Right? Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, we were totally talking about the same thing, even though we're not naming it.
Yeah, and when I finish a podcast, it automatically deletes it, so it's hard for me to go back and see what it is. But I like listening to those, too.
Okay, great. What about shows?
Right now I'm loving The Crown.
Okay, yeah, it's good.
Like a lot of other people.
I finished it last week. So good.
Mm-hmm. Also, I love Grace and Frankie.
I've seen one of those episodes. I just haven't gotten back to it. Yeah, it's funny.
Okay, mm-hmm. It's hilarious, and I love it. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is always a go-to.
Okay.
Saturday Night Live. Law and Order SVU, though, will be like my tried and true for the rest of my life.
Law and Order and what?
SVU. Law and Order SVU Special Victims Unit.
Oh, yeah. That's the one that when it comes on, I turn it off as fast as I can.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really intense.
Yeah. I have to be. Yeah. I get. Yeah. Yes, it is. But you know what? I can tell it's very entertaining. I mean, it's good. Yeah.
I think part of me, my like theological reflection on SVU is that we all like long for the sense of justice in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the times it gives you justice in an hour. Well, nice. One form of justice. One form.
Yeah.
There are many.
Right. Right. You are so in seminary. I mean that in the best possible way. I miss it. And I think you're going to miss chapel. That's actually what I found myself thinking. Like when you're talking about that being part of your self-care, I was like, oh man, I wonder if she's going to miss that when she leaves. So is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wish I had asked you, Amanda?
I don't think so. I mean, like I said, your questions were the real deal. Yeah, no, I mean, nothing's like popping out. It's like, hey, you really want to talk about this.
Okay, all right. Anything else you want to add?
Nope. I mean, is there anything that you feel like, I mean, you probably asked me whatever you thought.
Gosh, you know, you said a little bit about Megan. I feel like I could just ask you, like, how'd you meet Megan? And how'd you, you know, and just ask you all those things, too. I'd love to, like, yeah. Next time you're in Charlotte, let's go and we'll go get coffee and I'll ask you all those questions.
Yeah, that is a crazy story in and of itself.
I feel like I read. Is that in some of the blog that you wrote?
I kind of talk a little bit about it in the blog, mm-hmm. just because, just kind of name it. But I had a purpose with that blog. I had to focus on.
Okay, so what is your blog? Do you want to share it?
Sure. I mean, it just has right now. It only has that one post.
Mm-hmm.
It's amandalynkerr.wordpress.com.
Okay. So if people want to read.
The only post up there right now is Let Your Life Speak. And I'm hoping that once I have a little bit more time, I can share some more reflections on things like the grief process that a lot of people don't really think about in this journey, or what it's like to be engaged and planning a wedding, but in a completely different way than you ever thought. So, and just some resources for people who are trying to figure all this out, but it's all completely new. Like, I totally get that.
Yeah, I feel like you're going to do a lot with that over the next years and be a real support and resource for people. Well, that one blog post itself will be, I think, a great support for people who want to read it. Okay, last fun question. For your wedding with Megan, as you guys are planning, what are a couple of things that you guys are like wanting to be part of the ceremony that is just really important to you? That may be the same as a traditional wedding, or maybe not.
Yeah. Well, this isn't the ceremony, but we really wanted tacos at the reception.
Awesome. Taco bar? Like a taco?
I don't know if that's going to happen, but we wanted it.
Do it. You know what? One wedding I went to had a mashed potato bar, and it was awesome. It was so yummy.
That's a top priority, is food that people love.
Mm-hmm.
We joke about like wedding chicken and wedding beef. Like it's just like the same thing. You know, it's just.
Yeah.
Okay. So ceremony. Right now we're in the midst of figuring out like officiants.
Okay.
And so that's been quite a journey because there are people that mean a lot to us, and they would love to marry us, but within their current denomination, they can't.
Yeah.
They could, but it would cause a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So, we're really hoping to find a couple people who've been really influential in our journey as individuals and as a couple to stand up there and marry us and bear witness to that.
Nice.
So that's something we're getting close to, I think, every day. And I mean, the one thing that I'm really excited about is that that chapel is going to be full of just people who love us and have been present with us on this journey. And some of them are connected, others of them aren't.
Yeah.
But for us all to be together, it's just going to be a really super special thing.
Yeah, that's really touching, really beautiful. So, okay.
Because it feels like it's not just me and her, right? Yeah. Yes, it's me and her, but it's like this entire community that, like, one of my friends was like, when y'all get engaged, I feel like we all get engaged.
Wow. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Amanda, for spending so much time with me. And I am going to be so excited about getting this one out. I'm hoping I'll probably be working hard on it over the weekend. But yeah, I really, your story is sacred to me. And thank you for sharing it and being willing to share it with others. So, and I hope this is a start where I can maybe talk to you more. That'll be great.
Yeah, no, that would be great. I'll definitely let you know the next time I'm home with free time. And
yeah, let me know. Well, maybe we can debrief from the podcast experience.
I'll say, wow, so exhausted.
Well, oh man, that was, she was actually just worried. What she said was, I was so tired. I was so, like, she was worried about how she sounded. And then when she went back and heard it, she's like, oh, it's fine. Yeah. Yeah. She was like, I didn't sound tired, but you know what? I'll see you in a month. I need to make sure I get to hug you at Y Christian.
Yes.
Will Megan be there too?
That'd be awesome. I'm not sure if she will be or not. She's kind of gone back and forth.
Okay.
So.
All right. Either way, I will see you. Okay. Yes, all right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amanda. Okay, bye.
Thanks again for joining us on Unstuck. If you've enjoyed today's episode, would you consider sharing it on your preferred social media platforms and giving it a review on iTunes? Giving it a review and sharing it makes the podcast more visible to others, and I want people to benefit from the powerful stories being shared here. Until next time, breathe life in deep, embrace the journey, and notice the details. See you later, friend.